So speaking of software, let's use this moment to transition into another piece of software. You guys are selling some software called TetherSim. Right now on your website, it says that you're rewriting the code base, so it's not available for purchase. But TetherSim looks like a very handy tool.
Yeah, TetherSim is a simulation code or simulation tool set that I've developed over the past two decades to enable us to analyze and design space tether systems. So it combines simulation models for simulating tether flexural dynamics, as well as satellite orbital and attitude dynamics, with NASA standard environmental models for things like the atmospheric density, the ionospheric concentrations, the magnetic field, and a bunch of other stuff, solar pressure, that sort of thing, so that we can do simulations of tether systems, such as looking at how long it takes to drag a satellite down in orbit with a terminator tape, or how quickly we can maneuver a microsatellite using a electrodynamic tether. We've also used it for looking at ideas like flinging satellites to the moon using long rotating high strength tethers. Yeah, so that's a tool. I mainly developed it for my own purposes. We have in the past sold a few seats of it here and there to various researchers and organizations. Because there haven't been a whole lot of funding for space tether work, the code is kind of decrepit at this point. It was using a whole bunch of Apple Macintosh stuff that Apple stopped supporting 10 or 15 years ago. So I currently have a really good software engineer who's updating it to run on multiple platforms and use more modern graphics and other stuff. So we're working on that, and hopefully that'll be ready for us to use on a new project in the coming months.
So that's for designing systems, not for designing trajectories, which is kind of what I assumed it was for.
No, not really for designing trajectories. It's really more for looking at how a tether wiggles and swings when you're doing electrodynamic thrusting, or for looking at momentum exchange tethers that can throw a payload from one orbit to another, looking at how that would work.
Yeah, by the way, I don't know if you've ever read the book Seven Eves, but in the final third of the book, they rely heavily on momentum transfer tethers, and it's really weird to hear somebody talk about them as a real thing, because it's also kind of a bizarre technology. The physics works, but...
Seven Eves was a great book. Another really good one that talks about some of the tether ideas we've worked on is Luna New Moon by Ian McDonald. He's got a lunar tether system in that book. It's pretty cool. It's very, very beautifully described.
The next product on my list is really cool. It's the SunMill solar panel kit that you guys have. It's a deployable solar panel, but in the photos, it looks like the resultant area is too large to actually have fit on the surface of a 3U cube set. So could you tell us about this whole system and what makes it good for a customer?
Sure. So that we developed the SunMill under a SBIR contract from the Army's Space and Missile Defense Command, SMDC. And they gave us the challenge of coming up with a solution so that they could have 100 watts of power on a 3U cube set. To do that, we designed very thin but very stiff carbon fiber panels to put the solar cells on, and we can, with those, we can actually fit three panels that fold up together on each side of the CubeSat, so it unfolds to give you a whole lot of area. It can generate about 100 watts. Now, the challenge then is, what do you do with 100 watts on a 3U CubeSat,
right?
And how do you keep your CubeSat from glowing like a fire poker? But that, you know, that's another challenge.
Yeah, chat says lasers, which is exactly what I was thinking. Like, you give DoD 100 watts in a CubeSat and they're going to go blow something up.
It fits in the narrow end of the 3U CubeSat. So you're just talking about 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, right? Like that's where this all tucks into?
No, they actually fold up along the long sides of the...
Okay, because from the little graphic I'm looking at, it looks like it goes inside essentially a 1U volume of the 3U CubeSat. That's actually how I thought it worked, but I got it wrong.
No, it goes along the sides, and then we to steer the solar array, we use our Cobra gimbal, which is a carpal wrist gimbal mechanism designed upon the Canfield joints architecture, which is invented by a professor. I think he's at Tennessee Tech now, Stephen Canfield. Really brilliant mechanism design that enables us to steer that sun mill array over a full hemisphere without twisting up the electrical feed lines.
Just to give our listeners an idea of how large the surface area is, it looks like it's four panels, and it looks like each panel is three times the width of each of the long faces of a 3U CubeSat, right? So this must be two axes of motion for each panel, and then each panel also pops upward. Is that correct? Our chat is saying about 4 square feet on a 3U. I'm sorry, it's huge.
If you combine that 100 watts of power with our hydro thruster on a CubeSat system, you get a very maneuverable small sat.
A terrifyingly maneuverable small sat. That's really cool. So what does the actuation on this thing look like? I'm guessing that everything's just on springs and you just release it and it pops out?
Yeah, the unfolding is all actuated by springs, and it's all started by the Cobra gimbal, which kind of does an initial movement that lets everything start to unfold.
Oh, I see. So it must like pop them out of brackets or something.
Yep. Exactly.
That's super clever. So you literally don't need anything but the gimbal on the top of the thing. That's very, very cool.
Correct.
Okay. So could you describe a Canfield joint? And then I guess we can talk about your gimbal in particular.
Well, the Canfield joint is the basic mechanism design, and it's, I don't know how best to describe it. I mean, if you took like your thumb and two fingers and put all the tips together, It's kind of like that. Basically three arms, which have a shoulder and an elbow joint, and both of which can rotate in two axes. But you end up with a mechanism that can swivel over a full hemisphere of pointing. And one of the advantages of it is that it can rotate full 360 degrees without twisting up the feed wires that run through it.
Right, it's kind of a sunflower kind of motion in this hemisphere.
Yeah.
What did it take to develop one of your own, and do you have any other applications? Like, what's kind of the thinking on this thing?
Well, the challenge for us was designing it to fit in a very small volume. You know, we wanted to make one that would fit in a CubeSat, so that took careful design and really precise machining and then we had to figure out how to control it, because it's a very complex, mathematically complex joint. So we worked out the inverse kinematics for controlling it. And then in terms of applications, you know, we started out with pointing a solar array, which only needs about 10 degrees of accuracy to work. But then since then, we've worked with a couple of big aerospace primes who are developing intersatellite communications link payloads, and we've supplied the pointing solution for those. One of those was high frequency RF, and the other was actually optical. And that was extremely challenging. The optical payload had very extreme requirements for pointing precision, but we were able to hit the requirements there. So we've got the capability to make a very high precision pointing solution. And then, you know, the other big challenge is getting that complex mechanism to survive launch vibrations and shocks. You know, so that also takes very, very careful design of the way you hold things down, and you know the way everything fits together, so that it, you know, can take that assault and battery and still work.
I think one of the brilliant things about this design is that even though it's got three arms, and then each arm, I guess, has got four axes. Axes of Freedom, is that correct?
Yeah, I think so, but then they're all tied together. So overall the system has 3 degrees of freedom. But yeah, there are parts that are going in several different directions.
Yeah, but I mean, like, these arms are like not simple backhoe arms. Like they've got some extra parts in there. But all of this is driven by three motors because the system is constrained.
Yep. And that's why the math to be able to control it is pretty complicated.
Dude, it's really cool that you can use such a simple, I mean, relatively simple system to do some very complex motions. Because you not only get pointing, but like you said, it also can stand up and squat down, which allows you to do some pretty complex solar panel actuation movements. It's very cool.
Another application we are planning on using it for is as a actuator at the end of our robotic arm, because it can kind of act like a wrist and provide very precise positioning and pointing capabilities. And we've been working with NASA Ames to build a version of this that will go on their Astrobee pre-flyer robot that will go up into the space station. Back in November, December, we worked with them to integrate a prototype of it onto the engineering model of the Astrobee, so it can provide pointing and positioning of sensors and actuators and tools for the Astrobee free flyer.
Oh, that's so cool. I didn't know that was happening. That's really awesome. So for anybody who's familiar with the Spheres experiment, Astrobee is basically Spheres with a purpose, right?
Yeah, so it'll provide capabilities to assist the astronauts on the space station, both manipulating things on the space station as well as, you know, observing what the astronauts are doing or you know, other parts of the space station.
One other product you have is something called GRASP, Grapple Retrieve and Secure Payload. And I'm looking at the website. There's not a whole lot that I can tell from that. So I was wondering if you could explain exactly what this is and what's its purpose. And it says that this has been demonstrated. So if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Sure. So GRASP is basically a deployable net intended to enable a small spacecraft to capture a piece of space debris or other non-cooperative space object. So it's part of a potential solution to the space debris problem, where you've got all these rocket bodies and dead satellites and bits and pieces of stuff that are floating around. And one of the challenges is that these dead satellites, dead rockets are, they're typically tumbling, and typically they don't have a convenient handle to grab onto. So we developed this net, which we can kind of pop open using lightweight temporary inflatable tubes, and then the satellite could maneuver the net around the object and then cinch it up, kind of like a purse seine net on a fishing boat. So it provides a way of being able to grab onto something that isn't cooperating with you. And then we could either use an electrodynamic tether to tow it over to a recycling station, or pop open a terminator tape or some other deorbit device to drag it down out of orbit.
Yeah, because I was wondering exactly how you would maneuver it. But if this is something which is maybe like tumbling, as you said, how would you deploy terminator tape? Would that still be possible?
Yeah, it's possible. It would have to be tape deployment mechanism would have to be designed differently. We had a project funded by NASA's Innovative Advanced Concepts, or NIAC, program a few years ago called Wrangler, where we looked at using this approach to be able to capture and detumble a near-Earth asteroid. The idea is we'd pop open the net, use it to kind of latch onto a big rotating asteroid, and then slowly pay out a tether. And if you do it properly, if you can control the rate at which you deploy the tether, you can keep the tether system stable, keep it from wrapping around the asteroid, take advantage of rotational kinematics to enable a very small satellite, like a 10 kilogram nanosat, to detumble a huge asteroid massing, you know, a million kilograms or more.
That just blew my mind. All right.
Yeah. So like on upper stages, like yo-yo D-spin devices have been a thing for a while. And I'm trying to remember, there's one particular rocket I was looking at recently that used a yo-yo D-spin device, but to detumble an asteroid, I mean, that's not just spinning along one nice, tidy, long axis. That's
right.
Spinning in multiple directions and actually tumbling. It's pretty cool that, you know, conservation of momentum still works.
Yeah. Their approach is very similar to a yo-yo D-spin device. But yeah, rocket is typically spinning around its long axis in a fairly predictable manner. An asteroid or debris object is going to have complex moment of inertia, and it'll be tumbling, you know, on two or three axes. But we did do simulations with TetherSim and with some other tools that showed that, you know, if we control the rate at which we deploy the tether properly, we can detumble multi-axis spins successfully.
So how much knowledge do you have to have about the movement of the asteroid to be able to predict what rate you're going to want to deploy your tether at?
You need to know the overall rotation rates, which you can get from, you know, a star sensor or something like that. But then you also need to know what the tether is doing with respect to the object you're spinning. So you need some kind of relative position between the end mass out at the end of the tether and the point at which it's attached to the object.
I guess you could do that optically, or?
Well, we could do that optically, but we could also do that using the relative navigation sensor that we developed, you know, from which we ended up developing the Swift software-defined radio platform. So we could put a radio on the object and on the end mass and get them talking together. And from that, we could get enough knowledge of what's going on to control the system.
You also offer, apparently, radiation shielding, which is another big thing for, you know, space flight. So could you talk about exactly in what capacity you provide radiation shielding? And it looks like it's specifically for various electronic components. So not, you know, for people, let's say, but for hardware.
Sure. So in the satellite industry, particularly in the CubeSat and SmallSat fields, a lot of the advances that have been made in the performance of small systems have been based upon the use of commercial off-the-shelf electronics. So instead of using the very expensive, very big, bulky, and low-performance radiation-hardened components that, you know, big, high-profile space missions will typically use, you know, you go to DigiKey and other electronics vendors and just buy the same kind of components that are going into cell phones and computers and that sort of thing. Those components they're a lot less expensive and they can provide much higher performance, but they're not designed to operate reliably in a high radiation environment. So what we call VSRS, V-S-R-S, what we're doing is using multi-material 3D printing, printing with a combination of low atomic weight polymers and high atomic weight metals, and making kind of a layer cake structure that is very efficient at attenuating the energetic electrons and protons that are present in the radiation belts of Earth. Kind of the way that works is the low atomic weight plastic is very good at slowing down and stopping the electrons and protons as they come in. But as you decelerate the electrons and protons, they give off high energy X-rays. So then you have a layer of high atomic weight metal to absorb the X-rays. But then the X-rays tend to kick off additional electrons and protons. So you have another layer of low atomic weight stuff to stop those. And by using 3D printing, we can make complex geometries with this layer cake structure that can fit around electronics. So, for example, in our Swift radios, we can make versus boards that fit in between the radio boards, in a very tight space in between the boards to provide spot shielding to sensitive components. And we can make more complex geometries that will fit around, you know, other sensors, imagers, that sort of thing.
So it's not just as simple as using 3D printing filament with flecks of metal in, because, you know, that's something that home 3D printers are using, but you're actually like putting down layers of plastic and then having an entire layer of metal and then adding more plastic, right?
Well, primarily we're using compounded materials. So it is little bits of metal in the plastic.
Okay.
So, you know, it's stuff that it's material that could, in theory, be made on a traditional 3D printer. Our kind of our secret sauce is we've developed a software tool set for being able to design, to come up with these designs and optimize design in a very efficient manner. So customers can give us, you know, a CAD file of their parts. They can tell us where the sensitive parts are. They can give us limits for how much volume and mass we can use, and also tell us the particular environment they're going to be in, you know, what orbit they're going to be in. And then the software tool will crunch through all the different options and come up with a very optimized design that then we can send right to a printer.
Are you guys printing in-house, or are you farming this out to somebody else, if you don't mind me asking?
Both. We have internal capability, but we're also working with one of the big top-tier 3D printer organizations to be able to make it. So it's, you know, we can make prototypes in-house, and then for doing quantity production, we have a, you know, a big partner that we can work with.